What's good and welcome to the Hockey Mailbag, the first sports podcast run by you, the listeners. I'm your host, Brandon Rewicki, and each episode follows a simple format. You send me whatever hockey-related questions are on your mind, and I provide the answers. If you want to be a part of the podcast, just send your questions to thehockeymailbag@gmail.com or to me on Twitter at Brandon_Rewicki. All right, we're back at it again after kicking off the new year in style last week. Kind of felt like a pretty quiet stretch around the NHL these last few days. Maybe the dog days of winter have hit us here. But thankfully, you guys brought the heat with what I would call a bit of a hodgepodge or a potpourri of questions and comments for today's episode. Sometimes those are the best ones. So a little bit random. But let's dive on into the questions here. And we get things started with our man, Jimbo. And Jimbo asks, oh, wow, a playoff question. A playoff format question, I should say. Jimbo says, why on God's green earth has the NHL not moved on from this goofy-ass playoff format back to 1v8? Please, God, do not give me Kings Oilers for another year. All right, thanks for the question there, Jimbo. A very popular sentiment, I think, basically across, 95% of the NHL fan base? A longing for the days of the 1v8, no doubt about it. But since this is a trust tree, a safe circle, if you will, I kind of have to share a deep, dark secret with you guys here. I think I belong in the 5%. I actually don't mind the divisional playoff format that the NHL has come up with. It's led to some pretty damn good opening round matchups and even second round matchups, I would argue at this point. And once you get to the conference finals, you know, it's the final four, the best standing. You really can't go wrong with either format there. I kind of pick up what the NHL is putting down with their divisional playoff format. And this is always my big debate on this. When people push back against it and say 1v8 all the way, that's where you get the best matchups. You don't have to force feed these rivalries down our throat, which is fine. But my response to that always is, okay, you don't like the divisional matchups. What would the matchups be 1v8 in each conference, right? Like for this season. For example, what would that look like? What would the differences be, at least in the opening round, before we get into what the second and third rounds might look like? Well, I did a little bit of work here, about 10 seconds worth of it, and we can go through the differences right now. As it stands at the recording of this episode, under the NHL's current playoff format, in the East, we have Toronto versus the first wild card, which would be Boston, Florida versus Tampa Bay, Washington versus the second wild card, which is Columbus, nice, and New Jersey versus Carolina in the East. Out West, Vegas versus Vancouver, Edmonton versus LA, sorry, Jimbo, Winnipeg, Colorado, Minnesota, Dallas. All right? I mean, shockingly similar to what we saw last season, just a few little tweaks here and there, which I can understand people being upset with the same matchups over and over again to a certain degree. But if we go 1v8, these are the matchups in the opening rounds. In the East, Washington versus Columbus, Toronto versus Boston. Then we get New Jersey versus Tampa, Carolina versus Florida. I mean, which playoff matchups would you rather see? And really, it just comes down, it's, you know, same thing out West, where it's the wild card teams and the division leaders match up against each other. Nothing changes there. Vegas, Vancouver, Winnipeg, Colorado. But then you get Minnesota, LA, Dallas, Edmonton. Which grouping gives you a better playoff matchup in round one? Even though we'd see Edmonton, LA for the 19th straight season, I'm taking that first set of playoff matchups, man. I don't know. I kind of like it. And you do at least build in some sort of hatred and familiarity with these division matchups. You get the Battle of Florida once again between the Panthers and Lightning out East. Who's going to say no to the Toronto, Boston, and the Bruins winning that one in seven? Like, I don't know. I kind of like it. I think the real interesting part of this is, and what not enough people talk about, is that since the NHL has switched their divisions to two divisions in each conference, I don't think you're going to see the same volatility in the playoff matchups as you did in the NHL's previous format, which, yes, was 1v8, but I think most importantly, you had three divisions in each conference, right? Three division winners, which then led to some juicy 4v5 matchups, but you would have all these different teams playing each other. That's not going to be available if you go back to the 1v8 with the two divisions in each conference. You kind of get what I'm saying here? Like, I really don't think there's going to be all that much of a difference. I think the big gripe with the division format is that you get these situations that we've seen, especially in the Atlantic these past couple of seasons, where the 2-3 seed is locked in after 50 games, right? And there's really little to play for on both sides. Like, that part of it I do hate. You never want to see playoff seeds figured out before you head into March. You know what I mean? So that part of it I do get. And don't get me wrong. Like, if I had a choice, I would probably pick 1v8 over the divisional format. Like, if I had to go one way or the other. But I will say this. I'm not going to get on the NHL for how they've gone about it. I kind of like, they've force-fed us Capitals, Penguins, Crosby, Ovechkin, which were some of the best matchups we've seen in the NHL over the last 30, 40 years, right? Like, there's been a lot of good that's come with it. And then you still get, I think, some pretty interesting matchups the further down the playoff bracket that you get. So I'm not going to lose sleep either way, but I actually, this might be maybe the one thing the NHL does as a league where I'm kind of like, oh yeah, I kind of get it. I see the logic behind it there. But thanks for the question, Jimbo. I know I am in the vast minority on that one, but I wonder if I convinced anybody. Probably not. It's all good, though. Thanks, Jimbo. Let's move on here. We got a few more questions to get to. Louis is up next. And Louis asks, out east, why are Montreal fans so high on Lane Hutson, but scouts/hockey people still seem to be a bit skeptical? It's an interesting question. Oh, wow. A Montreal fan base overvaluing their young player. This is a first. No, I'm kind of kidding. But I'm actually with Habs fans on this one, so don't get all pissy at me. I think a lot of this stems too, I'm assuming, maybe I'm wrong, Louis, but I know Corey Pronman of The Athletic put out some kind of prospects or young player ranking article that had Lane Hutson like way, way down, like 29th or 30th. In terms of under 23 players or something like that, which I was shocked by. Why do they think that? I mean, it's kind of the obvious sentiment, isn't it, Louis? Hockey people are always going to hold a heavy dose of skepticism towards players that are sub 6 foot, sub 200 pounds, regardless of how much skill is packed inside that body. It is just going to happen. Probably for the rest of eternity. I just don't really see that changing anytime soon. I do kind of understand, and I've maybe come a bit more towards their side of thinking over the past few years on, you know, in certain cases. But man, this is part of where it's like, have you watched him play? Like, you turn on a Habs game and you watch Lane Hutson zoom all over the ice like a roadrunner. I mean, how could you not immediately fall in love with the way this guy plays hockey? He not only is he exciting, but he's effective. Like, it's not just he's not cardio Hutson, right? Like, he's getting his steps in, but how could you argue with the fact that he's on pace for 60 plus points as a rookie defenseman on a so-so Habs team playing better, right? But like, it's not like he's been, you know, insulated playing beside Chris Tanev or something. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he's finding his way in a young team that's on the up and up. So I don't really get it. To me, when it comes to young, small guys, maybe not even young, but just smaller guys in the NHL, I have all the time in the world for 5'9", 5'10 hockey players. Like, I don't really have the same hesitancy that a lot of other, maybe more Maybe you're kind of trending a bit older, right? Or more old school in your thinking. I don't feel that way. To me, though, if you're going to be on the smaller side in the NHL, there's two absolute guarantees. You've got to skate like the wind, and you've got to compete like all hell, right? You got to be a junkyard dog if you're going to be 5'9", 5'10", in the NHL. And there's got to be some serious boosters on those wheels. And guess what? Good news. Lane Hudson's got both of those things. The funny thing with Hudson, too, is, and I was kind of surprised, but he doesn't look that small on the ice, right? Like there's some big guys that play small. There's some small guys that play big. I think Lane Hudson's in that category there. But, I mean, you just get an elite skater out there on the ice, he's going to figure out and find a way to succeed. And he's probably been the smallest guy on the ice the majority of his hockey life. And sometimes those guys find a way to, for lack of a better word, survive and still thrive. I have no reservations about Lane Hudson being a future Norris finalist, you know, sometime in the next 5-6 years. I just think he's got all the skill in the world. I think he's going to get better defensively. I think already he's taken some leaps and bounds from where he was at the start of the season. I don't want to say watch the game to scouts that's literally all they do, but I don't know. I would need a little more in-depth analysis other than the fact of just mentioning what his height and what his weight is on his hockey DB page and then saying he needs to get better defensively. I don't know. I think with his speed, with his skating, he can be an effective player inside his own end, but get by on smarts, positioning, things like that. But man, once he gets the puck on his stick and he's going the other way, I don't know how many guys in the league already you would want ahead of Lane Hudson right now. So I'm on your side there, Louie. No worries, Habs fans. I would maybe cool it a little bit on the hype train, but the kid is legit, no doubt about it. Let's continue. We'll go a little further out east, I guess. We'll continue our trek on the East Coast. Maybe that's a better way to say it. Next up is at OVO. And OVO asks, where would you rank the Capitals amongst the Eastern Cup contenders this season? Very interesting question, OVO. Obviously, Washington taking the East by storm. A pretty healthy lead, 6-7 points-ish on a top spot in the conference. And this is kind of the, you know, I'm sure Washington fans won't appreciate this, and they might have a different opinion. But this is kind of the interesting question when you have a team that comes out of nowhere to a degree and sits near the top of the standings halfway through the season. How legit are they? How well do they compare it to the other beasts in that conference? I don't know. I'm just not buying Washington just yet. You know, and I look at the other teams there, even in their own division. Like, would you really pick them right now in a 7-game series ahead of Carolina and ahead of New Jersey? I just don't see it. Both those teams have a little more high-end talent. Carolina is almost just like a jacked up version of Washington to a degree. You know what I mean? Where Carolina is similar in that they get contributions up and down their lineup, but maybe just a little more high-end talent out there with the Hurricanes. I would feel pretty good about taking New Jersey in that series. In the Atlantic, I mean, Florida might be the number one team in the entire conference in terms of rankings. I think I'd go Tampa and Toronto ahead of Washington too. I don't know. I really like what Tampa's done, and I know maybe the record hasn't necessarily borne that out so far, but I think the Lightning are going to be a force and a much more formidable opponent in this year's playoffs than last. Toronto's a dumb pick because we're at playoffs, right? But the fact remains this. When you get into the postseason, what ultimately wins out? People say depth wins championships. It really doesn't, though. It all comes down. Yes, your depth needs to make contributions, but it's all about the high-end talent that you have, right? Like, Florida is deep as hell, no doubt about it. But Barkov playing out of his mind last year goes a long way into that, right? Ekblad was a force. Forsling, we'll get to him in just a sec, but amazing play out of him. Tkachuk, right? Ben, you go up and down the line. Sam Reinhart, a 60-goal scorer, basically. And then Bob and Nett. Like, there's just so much high-end talent. All these great teams really do have depth, but it's the big dogs that really push the pace and carry the way for them. And I just, I don't know. The Capitals have gotten major contributions from their top guys, but when push comes to shove in the postseason, I just like the other team's groups better. Which is, and it's weird too, because Washington, like team stats wise, doesn't really have a weakness. They're basically top 10 in everything. You look at the offensive stats, you look at the defensive stats. Analytically, this isn't, a PDO bender by them. Like they're pretty solid in terms of chances for, chances against. Special teams, top 10 in both power play penalty kill. Like it's one of those weird things where they're playing great hockey as a group. But we've seen this time and time again, and maybe the best comparison I could think of with this Washington team would be the Minnesota Wild of like the mid-2010s. You know what I mean? Like the Mikko Koivu, Granlund, Suter Parise Minnesota Wild, who team-wise would always be a tough out. They played a like really effective, tough style of hockey. But what happened once they got into the postseason? Like other teams would have more high-end talent. They would give more minutes to those guys, and they just weren't able to win those matchups as efficiently as they can do over the course of 82 games of a regular season. So, I mean, and look, that's not to say that Washington's guaranteed to be a one-and-done top seed. The fact is, like out of those teams I mentioned, New Jersey, Carolina, if Washington gets the one seed, one of them knocks out the other. Right off the bat. Same with Tampa Bay, Florida. One of them knocks off the other. At that point, you only have to beat two of those teams that I think are more equipped for postseason success, right? So it doesn't equate to a guaranteed early exit, but I would just say Cavs fans, enjoy the ride. Like, who cares? Your team's way better than you expected to be. And then you have the Ovi record chase, all that stuff. Like, it's good vibes all around. So enjoy the run, see where it goes. And I think most Washington fans would probably agree. Like, you end the season with a playoff series win. Still probably a pretty successful year because nobody expected you to chase the Stanley Cup. So thanks for the question there, OVO. We're a little bit behind here. So we got to pick up the pace a little bit. We'll see what we can do here. Next up on tap, Lenny. And Lenny asks, who could be the next Gus Forsling? Waiver wires to star. Interesting question there, Lenny. And I'm not saying this just because I'm trying to speed things up a little bit here, but my response to that would be, who the hell knows? Like, really, I think if anybody gives you a legitimate answer to that question, they're completely BSing themselves. I feel like if I gave you an answer, I'd sound like a pretentious a-hole. Like, I don't know. You look at Gus Forsling's rise to top pairing level defenseman is really unprecedented, because you're talking about a guy that was a fifth round pick by the Canucks in 2014, right? So 10 years ago, 10, 11 years ago at this point. Really did nothing as a Swedish junior player to think, oh, wow, late bloomer, we got somebody here. Goes to Chicago, where he's given opportunities to become an everyday player there, and he's fine. You know what I mean? Like, he's fine in Chicago, but I don't think there were too many Blackhawks fans at the time that he went on waivers that were worried, oh no, we've lost Gus Forsling, what's going to happen here? And he ends up spending 2 years in the AHL before he gets a chance with the Florida Panthers there, right? I mean, and he's average height for defenseman, like 6'1", 200 pounds. He's not super big, not crazy fast. Like, there were no real signs that this guy was going to be a dude, but then he just figures it out in Florida, right? So, like, it's not like one of those things where you can say, all right, there was this sign, this sign, this sign. Who fills a similar void there in this day and age? I just don't think people know. And I think if Florida knew, they would have picked him up sooner. Like, that's kind of what it comes down to. It was just a good stroke of luck. Maybe they saw something that other teams didn't, and Florida reaps the rewards. Maybe the lesson is to take more chances on waiver guys. Maybe there's just there are players in the NHL who aren't getting a full crack at an everyday spot in the lineup that can show a lot more. And I really think it's maybe the biggest thing that people missed out of the Golden Knights success story is that Vegas just gave guys a chance higher up in the lineup, and they were able to find some guys. I wonder if that's maybe the secret sauce in all this is maybe just give some guys in the minors a chance, see what happens. I don't really have a guy. Maybe, well, let's see. If he was picked in 2014, same timeline, 2018, let's go Declan Chisholm. How about that? I saw him here in Winnipeg. He's a good skater. You never know. But like, yeah, to give you an answer, I'd feel like I'm just BSing you. I don't have a good pick as to who the next forest lane is going to be. But appreciate the question either way there, Lenny. We move on. Let's go. This one's a little more out west. POW or POW. I like POW better. POW asks, which team would most like a redo of their busy offseason? Boston, Seattle, or Nashville? Yeah. Those would be three dumpster fire off seasons, no doubt about it there. You know, I will say this, though. I know it hasn't worked out in any fashion for Nashville. Like, all their moves in the last 8 months have completely backfired on them. But, I'll just go back to how I felt at the time. And I still, like, I liked what Nashville did. I understood what they were doing. Like, they were getting legitimate talent to come in and supplement what was a pretty feisty team last year, right? You have Forsberg, you have Yossi, you have Saros. Like, there was kind of a trio of high-end talent there that, you know, if you supplement that a little bit, maybe you move yourself up into the upper half of the Central Division. And I also get the Askarov trade, too. Like, if Saros is your guy, I know, again, he struggled this year, but, like, you can pick up some free assets for a guy that was never going to play for you anyways. It's just wild that every move Nashville has made has completely blown up in their faces so far. But obviously Nashville would probably like to redo it, but I understand why they did it. Seattle, it really just comes down to me with the Kraken, that Chandler Stephenson contract. I can understand Montour, right? Like, you're bringing in a guy that's, you know, got game. He was a high-end player, big-time minutes muncher on a cup team. Like, that to me makes sense, right? He fortifies your defense. Chandler Stephenson, I get what they're trying to do, where it's like, we've got Shane Wright, we've got Matty Beniers, Berkeley Catton coming up. We need somebody to kind of supplement them so it's not a la the Buffalo Sabres. We're just throwing three 20-year-old kids out there to the Wolves down the middle. I get the line of thinking. Brutal contract the second that pen touched paper. I mean, it would have made a lot more sense to give up legit assets for a guy that even had 1, 2, even 3 years left on a deal, right? And then there's a bit of a succession plan in place. But I can't sign off on that one. But to me, it's got to be Boston, doesn't it? Warning bells all over the place on the Elias Lindholm long-term contract. That looks like a major, major albatross. I don't think there's any way that we see Lindholm get back to the guy that he was in Calgary. That one's got buyout written all over it in probably 3 to 4 years, I would think. And then even the Zadorov deal, right? Like, he's fine. Like, but he is what he is. Like, I think people just got infatuated with his Canucks playoff run, but he's just a good, like, 4 or 5 defenseman that's gigantic and destroys people in the playoffs. But there's some liabilities to his game, and especially at $5 million per season. And you can even maybe make the case at this point, did Boston maybe trade the wrong goalie? Like, were they better off doing the Luongo Schneider thing? You know, when Vancouver traded Corey Schneider, they get the 9th pick, Bo Horvat, you keep Luongo. Would they maybe have been better off doing something like that, where Ullmark stays and Swayman's able to get you that centerman that avoids the Lindholm deal from happening? I think out of those three, even though it's been disasterville for Nashville, I might go Boston. That would like the most, the biggest redo of what they've done so far in the offseason. But thanks for the question there, pal. Two more to go here before we wrap it up. Riles is up next. And Riles asks, the Isles have to trade Brock Nelson, right? Yes. Quite simply, they do. Yes. This might be another one of those quick ones. I mean, yes, they're still in the playoff hunt, as is basically the entire Eastern Conference. But, I mean, let's be honest. Is there any legitimate semblance of an opportunity that the Islanders make the Final Four, let alone win a Stanley Cup. You know what I mean? It's just, it's not there with the team this year. It's not the same group that they were back when they went on those cup runs under Barry Trotz, who maybe deserves a bit more credit for those, the success of those teams than anything else. It's just not there. You've got an asset. He might be the number one center on the market at the deadline. You can get a first round pick back. Away you go. I think it's an easy decision there. I think GMs too get too caught up in the fact that just because you sell a major asset at the deadline, it doesn't mean your team's entering a full-on rebuild, right? You're just being realistic about where you are at in that point in time. And I think that's what smart GMs do. Doug Armstrong has done it twice extremely well. One of those years when he moved Paul Stastny, when St. Louis was in a playoff spot, that led to them getting the assets to make the move for Ryan O'Reilly if they win the cup the next year. I think that's why GM or where GMs can maybe get a little more savvy, I guess, in terms of just taking a step back and being like, it's not in the cards. We reload and we can make a run at it with a new group next year. And I would say that's the spot that the Islanders are in right now. Although you look at that New York squad, you do wonder if there is a high-end team based out of the people that they have in there. And I didn't even know this, but Matt Barzal in a couple of months will be 28 years old. Like, JC, man, I thought he was like a 23-year-old still. Time's coming for us all. I'd be a little worried about that if I'm an Islanders fan to go on with some of the other issues they have there. But I think, yeah, Brock Nelson, it's got to be an absolute no-brainer, even though Lou's running the show there. It's an easy one. Get a first-round pick, maybe more. I think Toronto would be a great spot for him, but I don't know if the Leafs are, I don't know if Lou's going to be willing to do business with the Leafs. So we'll keep an eye on that as we get closer to the deadline, under 2 months away from now. And the final question of the episode goes over to Nashty. And Nashty asks, I guess kind of a comment, you mentioned last week about a plan to save the All-Star game, or at least make it watchable. Let's hear it. Yes, Nashty. I love it. Somebody's listening. I got one. Beauty. Yes. So for those that are maybe tuning in for the first time, we were talking about the Winter Classic, and I had mentioned that maybe the best thing for the Winter Classic long term is to make it the All-Star game, which I kind of still think that. But I for those that missed it, I said there's something else I think that would make the All-Star game an absolute must watch. And I kind of teased it. And thank you, Nashty, for buying that hook, line, and sinker here. But here's my plan on what I think would make the NHL All-Star game absolute must-watch. And it kind of gets down to the fundamentals of why All-Star games suck, for the most part. And maybe why Major League Baseball is the only one that has a legitimately good All-Star game. Right? It's not the amount of high-end talent that's there. That's not the issue for any of these sports, right? But what is the one thing that makes All-Star games unwatchable? It is the lack of competitive fire, right? I mean, you had Kucherov getting booed off the ice in skills comp, let alone the actual All-Star game, right? But like NBA, NFL, NHL, no real physicality, no real fire, no real stakes at play, and the competitiveness just gets dropped all the way down to a Sunday beer league game at 11:30 p.m. right? Like it's just not there. So to me the question then is, how do we instill competitiveness into an All-Star game? And I think the answer is really simple, and I think it's kind of brilliant if I do say so myself. But I'm talking about a Mortal Kombat style tournament. Maybe that's a bad example. A March Madness-style bracket, or maybe Mortal Kombat. I kind of like Mortal Kombat. We'll do Mortal Kombat. A Mortal Kombat-style tournament. And what we do, and I'm open to suggestions, I'm open to alterations here, but for argument's sake, we'll do this. We pick, out of all the players selected to the All-Star game, we pick teams of two. One forward, one defenseman. Or we do two, whatever, but we'll say pairs. And we have a tournament of two versus two teams consisting of All-Stars going head-to-head. We could do first goal wins. We can do first to two goals, whatever it is. But we cut the ice in half to make it a little bit smaller because I think 3-on-3 hasn't worked. The full-length ice surface isn't going to make it something that I think is feasible in a 2v2 style matchup. But we basically have two players going up against two. And again, either first goal wins or first to three wins. And we create a tournament based off of that. And so, for example, we could have, hell, I don't know, McDavid Crosby versus, who do you want to go with? McDavid Crosby versus MacKinnon and Draisaitl. Could be one potential matchup there, right? And I think once you make it something where it's, you know, a little more intimate and a little more at stake in terms of, for these athletes at least, bragging rights, a little bit of mano-a-mano, who's the best of the best of the best, I think we see a little bit of extra juice out of these games and out of these matchups. You're telling me if you put those four guys that I mentioned on an ice surface that's split in half and you tell them first goal wins, that there wouldn't be a decent amount of busting your ass between those four guys there. And especially the further and further you get into the tournament, right? You get some underdog stories as well. You know, maybe it's a double defenseman team that makes a run to the final. Maybe it's two 20-year-olds. Maybe it's two 38-year-olds. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of potential there where you kind of shrink the ice surface, shrink the people involved, and you get this very interesting bracket slash tournament style format that is unlike anything we've really seen in North American All-Star games before, right? Like, it would be a first. I think it would draw a ton of intrigue and interest from people outside of the hockey world seeing this for the first time. And you can figure out what the award is for the team that ultimately wins the whole tournament, right? But there's something kind of badass about, you know, if you end up winning it, being like, hey, we're the two best, right? Like, we're the best All-Stars out of all the All-Stars. I think that's the way to go. The goalies, do they get screwed? Yeah, sure, but who cares? They're goalies. It's not going to be perfect. I grew up with goalies, parents, brothers. So I have no time for worrying about the goalies. But the point remains there that I think that is ultimately the best way to do it. Create a tournament. Have these guys go head-to-head. We don't have to worry about divisions, conferences, all that stuff. We just pick the best players in the NHL. You can do a draft of it live, too, where maybe the fans pick the teams, maybe the players pick the teams themselves, whatever it is. I think that would just, I just think it would be kick-ass. I think that's the one way you would get these guys to actually try over the course of an All-Star game. And it wouldn't be that long either, right? Like, you do the skills comp the day before the All-Star game itself. I mean, how long are they on the ice for? Like, a couple minutes, right? They're not playing 20 minutes. It's, I don't know. I think it's the way to go. I actually think the NBA would be best suited to do this, where they could just have a 1v1 tournament, right? Like, and that would get the NBA players. I think it would suit that sport best, but I'm a believer that it would work in the NHL. I think it's something that they should definitely look into, and I think they would get a lot of buy-in from the players as well. So that's my grandmaster plan. The All-Star Game is the Winter Classic, and we have Mortal Kombat battles to the death. And by the death, I mean sudden death of first goal wins. We find out who the best 2v2 team is in the NHL. It's the way to go. And that's where we'll end the episode here. Thank you guys so much for tuning in to another episode of the Hockey Mailbag. Really appreciate once again getting to hang out with you beauties and for stopping by. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to be a part of the podcast, just send your questions to thehockeymailbag@gmail.com or to me on Twitter @Brandon_Rewicki. We'll be back at it next week, Thursday morning. But until then, I'm your host, Brandon Rewicki. Have fun, stay safe, and I look forward to talking puck with you guys again soon.